Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Investigation Discovery's Murder Chose Me, featuring legendary Shreveport, Louisiana homicide detective Rod Demery, returns for its second season on Wednesday, April 4th at 10 p.m., 9 Central, only on ID. The series follows Demery as he reflects on memorable cases from his 14 years as a homicide detective, where he miraculously achieved a confession and 100% solve rate in the more than 250 homicide cases where he served as lead detective. Demery himself is no stranger to tragedy, having experienced an incredible loss at the age of 3 when his mother was murdered. Then, when Demery was in his 20s, his brother was convicted of murder and sentenced to life in prison. Offering a uniquely personal connection to the story of each homicide he solved, Murder Chose Me takes viewers on a journey with Demery as he continues to be driven by his one mission in life, to find justice and resolution for the families of murder victims just like his own. In each of the 10 all-new episodes of Murder Chose Me, intimate first-person storytelling meets the gritty Shreveport, Louisiana backdrop as Demery personifies how very impactful and life-altering murder is on the victim's loved ones. The program we're featuring today is Murder Chose Me, Investigation Discovery, Season 2, with my special guest, filmmaker and detective Rod Demery. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview. Detective Rod Demery, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Incredible. I just viewed the opener that everyone is able to look at on April 4th, the second season, the opener. Incredible. Let's get to a little bit of the background that really... that we just spoke a bit about at the age of 3 when your mother was murdered. Tell us a little bit more about your mother's murder and your brother being sentenced to life in prison, and really how this really shaped your career as a homicide detective.
Well, I think my mother's murder and my brother's committing murder kind of gave me a balance that was pretty unique, the fact that I could relate to someone who's experienced that in their lives, a survivor or murder victim's family. I could actually feel what they're going through, children that, you know, when they lost a parent, I knew what they were going to experience. As far as my brother's case, I could relate to some of the suspects because I knew exactly what it was like to have a brother. And what he did, you know, I guess I just learned to separate the crime from the criminal and realize that it's something they did and not something they were. So I think it gave me a balance that I just don't think I would have gotten otherwise. That's just a God's divine plan, I suppose.
Now, this is the second season of Murder Chose Me. Of all the cases that you did in the 14 years, just curious, what was the criteria you used for separating those stories and saying these are the kinds of stories that we're going to have in these seasons of Murder Chose Me? What was the criteria for picking what case you would feature?
You know, I don't know that there was a real formula there. You know, we talked about most of the cases, and a lot of them were memorable. I think the initial cases were the ones that were just probably most forefront in my mind for whatever reason. You know, maybe the dynamics of the case or just the way I just remembered it. But I don't think we had a real systematic way of doing it. I think the idea was I wanted to get as many cases as possible, and I think they wanted as many as possible. So I don't know that there was a real selection process other than that.
Now, tell us how you come to, what is the mix in the in this series, in this Investigation Discovery series? It's a half-hour episodes, or pardon me, one-hour episodes. And so tell us really what it's a mix of, dramatization and interviews. Tell us how, what the viewers might look forward to in terms of the mix of the components in this series on Investigation Discovery.
Yeah, absolutely. I host and narrate the show. So I tell the story, and as I go through the story, at certain points, they go to the reenactments, and there's an actor, John Nicholson, who plays me, and they reenact certain parts of the crime. Then it cuts back to me where I'm telling the story. Some of the witnesses and, you know, media and family members that were there during the time, they're also interviewed. But it's a mix of my first person telling story and a reenactment that gives a visual view of what actually really happened. And it's pretty vivid. I think it's a pretty seamless transition, and it works. It seems to have worked pretty well so far.
Absolutely. Tell us a little bit before we get right into this story, the episode opener on April 4th that people will be able to see. Tell us a little bit about Shreveport, Louisiana, and especially the neighborhood that this crime is involved with.
Yeah, Shreveport's a southern city. It's a pretty old city. It's an old southern town, I guess is probably the best way to describe it, that's grown into somewhat of a town with an urban area. The demographics are, it's probably 54-56% black, and it's just one of those cities that at one point was in a serious decline. You know, obviously crime rises with that, but it's also a pretty small neighborhood. It's, you know, one of those small towns where everybody seems to know anybody. There's great hospitality, and it's probably what most people would consider a hometown, a southern hometown.
Right. You also talk about, we might as well get to this right now, that there is something that is a situation with an industry that's in Shreveport, and it affects this case somewhat, and we'll explain that. But tell us a little bit about what Shreveport has as an industry that not everyone does have.
Yeah, it's we have a movie and television industry where, you know, there was a lot filmed there pretty heavily at one point, especially during this particular case. And it brings, you know, obviously some economic growth and some employment for the citizens there. You know, one of our biggest challenges or issues or to, just like most cities our size, was to try to gain that type of growth for our city and you know, hope for our people, you know, when jobs start to dry up. So I think that was a godsend. You know, there was just so much being brought to the city at the time when this case took place. So it was obviously important that we made sure everybody that was there safe.
Now, in Murder Chose Me, this first episode, you have a woman out jogging, and she comes to a spot, and the car's doors are open. Well, what does she see? Tell us about this opening scene, and of course, you were right there investigating this from beginning to end, so tell us about this scene. What does she find?
Yeah, absolutely. As she's jogging, she sees a car, and the door on the car is ajar, so obviously it grabs her attention. She looks inside, and there are two people in the front seat. They're shot. One person slumped over the other, and there's another person in the back seat who has been shot. And obviously, it's a traumatic scene for her. So you have three people that are shot in the car as she's just jogging by. And obviously, she's distraught and runs and calls the police. You know, the patrol officers get there. Once they get there, they call investigations. And I happen to be the on-call detective at that time and responded to the call and met with them. Her then, clearly shaken up, but her initial sight or first thing she saw was three people shot in the car.
You have a really dramatic opening, though, in terms of she sees two people slumped in the front seat covered in blood, and she looks at the back, and then someone from the back, like, comes alive, like out of a horror movie, and this contributes to her running off and screaming, doesn't it? Tell us who these three people are and the condition of the person in the back seat that isn't quite dead.
Okay. Yeah, they were – actually, one of them worked for a caterer that serviced the movie industry, and the other two were friends. The one in the back seat had been shot as the ones in the front, but the ones in the front weren't moving, so it was a pretty still scene up front. The person in the back had been shot, but as the door opened or as she peered inside the car, the person in the back seat moved. And, you know, it's pretty common for crime scenes where there's been, you know, numerous gunshots and people that are shot. The rush at that point is to anybody that survived, get them to the hospital. Clearly, somebody that's just running by or jogging by that sees that, you know, they have no idea what to do, so they call the police.
Now, you say they take Troy Creighton to the hospital, and he's in a condition that you can't question him right away, but you process this scene and take a look at the scene. What is it? What are the conclusions that you and your partners, and especially you, what conclusions do you make from that crime scene?
Well, immediately I knew that there had to be another crime scene, and that's because there was an absence of shell casings. Yeah, we had numerous gunshots into a vehicle, but there were only two shell casings there. So either that person was shot somewhere else, or the people were shot somewhere else, or somebody cleaned up the crime scene. Either way, it wasn't the original crime scene.
Now you talk about that this is not in the best area of town where you find these shell casings, but you say this is not the crime scene per se. You realize that right from the get-go. What do you find almost immediately as a result of this investigation, or how it progresses very quickly, about the possibility of where that original crime scene was?
Well, the fact that there were no shell casings there, you know, that was the immediate question. But one of the patrol officers told us that there was a shots fired call that was a couple blocks away just prior to that. So, you know, the immediate thought or the obvious thought is that maybe that shooting took place there and they were moved or transported to that area. And that was the key, the fact that, you know, there was, within a short period of time, there was a shots fired call before that. And, you know, here we are at this crime scene now that's missing some key evidence. So the immediate thought is to go back there and check out that call. And sure enough, that's where the shots actually originated.
Now, what do you find at this original crime scene that leads you to other leads?
Well, there was a witness there, the rest of the shell casings. So, you know, just at that point, just kind of marrying those two crime scenes together and bringing, you know, all that together and trying to piece the story together from that point.
There is an abandoned house in the area, and you decide to take a look in that house. And what do you find in that house in terms of any kind of connection to this murder?
Yeah, there was a person in the house, and that person had some blood on him, so our initial thought was that maybe they were involved in it, and that would be a witness. So we brought that person in to see if we could get some more information out of him.
You had actually also found a bloody shirt that was discarded in that area as well. And so obviously you're going to send that for testing, weren't you?
Yeah. It's, you know, it was actually a trail that led back to that initial crime scene. And the shirt was clearly, or at least at that point, I thought that it was part of that crime scene.
Tell us what you find at this abandoned house, and who do you find, and what is the story, and tell us about this as in terms of a good lead.
Well, if you watch from that point on the show, it'll show you how it develops and how he and all the other pieces come together, and the actual episode kind of weaves all the little pieces together. I don't really want to give anything away or spoil anything, but all the elements that come through, you can see how it goes from the initial call to detectives coming out and our investigation, and it just kind of progresses through that way. I think the biggest parts of this particular case were the the interrogation and the people that came, the witnesses that were developed, and it just kind of seamlessly works together. You know, of course, at the time, it doesn't seem like it's going to work out that way, but the way we present it, and I don't want to give away too much, but the way we present it, it kind of brings everything together and kind of shows how those cases work.
Well, in not giving anything away, you do get to see in this, which, again, we talked about the mix of things, the redramatization, but the very important stuff, especially for a nonfiction audience, and especially this, the nonfiction elements completely, and really important, the interviews that you have. Obviously, you have the man that's killed in the front seat. You have to go and give that kind of information about this death to her. You actually have interviews with her, and then you have a redramatization. In doing this, you have all of the important players in this, and in very important interviews as well, and then redramatizations to round this out. In telling this story here, what is it that you think is most represented in this story when you say the separate things come together and you show how those elements intertwine and one lead, which doesn't seem so promising, leads to another solid lead? What is really, in this episode, I guess maybe the underlying thing that people could take away from it?
I think what people can, or what they're probably going to take away from it is, you know, how that works, you know, how you get there and you're excited about one lead and then that kind of fizzles, and then, you know, you're maybe not so excited about another one and that one kind of, you know, materializes. All the elements that it takes to solve a murder, I think, you know, from just talking to witnesses and people in the community, and I think probably the statements from the victim's friends, and obviously the interrogations, you know, all these are brought back. And the mix that you talk about is, you know, I'll talk on camera about how, you know, I brought this person in and I interviewed him, and then we'll switch to a scene where they actually play the actual interrogation tape, and then, you know, we'll switch back and I'll say, you know, this person said this, and we'll cut to a scene where the person is, you know, acting that out, and it just kind of flows together. And I think probably the takeaway would be, you know, when someone watches the show, they'll see how it unfolds from start to finish, and, you know, the actual drama and the emotions involved are pretty well represented. So I think, and as you like you mentioned about that opening scene, you know, all those things that typically aren't available, you know, if you're watching the news or something and you hear about a case, I think in this, with the show, you can actually go step by step and just, you know, kind of follow the case from my eyes, I guess is probably the best way to put it.
Without giving anything away, I think we can still talk about this story for people to have a really interest in this season two, and to take a look at this. When you talk about your police work, it's evident in this story that you do not employ any kind of tunnel vision or jump to any kind of conclusions. And because if you were to jump to some conclusions, you would, number one, interview witnesses differently and assume different things. And like I say, with a tunnel vision, you might go down a route that really doesn't lead to a resolution like it does in this case. And you talk about this bottom. So tell us a little bit about the bottoms and what it's known for, and at least initially what police might have thought was in terms of motive, because you didn't have any motive for this murder, did you?
No. Actually, you know what? That's a pretty good observation. You know, I don't. You know, and I think that's probably the most successful way to work any case. And you know, the Bottoms has a reputation for being a red light district. And the immediate thought from people is that, you know, when they see an unexplainable crime, is, you know, maybe it's drugs, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. And you're absolutely right that when you go in, and if you have a mindset like that, you know, just kind of, you know, chalking things up to be, you know, where they are or who they are, then you're going to lose a lot. You're going to miss a lot. And, you know, that's an unfortunate thing that, you know, an unfortunate thing that happens often. You know, I mean, I thank God that I didn't have that type of attitude, and probably because of my life experiences and the things that I've seen, you know, I didn't have the ability to do that. But, you know, that's a pretty good observation, because not many people have actually picked up on that. But the reality is that, you know, some crimes are unsolved before they're even started because of a preconceived notion about an area or a person or people involved in the crime.
Right. Now, you talk about this, it's interesting, too, because what we talk about is that, again, no tunnel vision employed here, and you have to have that kind of technique to be successful, especially as incredibly successful as you have been. But also the way you unfold this in this documentary, this television series, is that it's very much like the real day-to-day work that you do. Not every single case is as memorable enough to get on the screen. But it is an unfolding mystery, isn't it? And you that very much demonstrated in this first episode.
Oh, it absolutely is, and you know, and again, that's probably the biggest part of it, because they're all mysteries, and you know, and when you go in with a particular mindset or a notion that, you know, it's going to be this or that, and you want to predict this or predict that, is where you kind of lose track of it. I think the big takeaway from it, and I think what's actually the blessing in all of it is that people can actually see that how it works, and with that in mind, they can understand how some attitudes and ideas affect the way you think when it comes to crimes like homicide, murder, or any other violent crime like that. You have to interject a human aspect of it. You know, it's not something that you can just learn and practice, because you're absolutely right. You start developing tunnel vision. You start thinking, well, you know, you're going to predict this and predict that. I think the hallmark of any good homicide detective or police officer, for that matter, is to have an ability to kind of suspend what you think and go with what you know. And, you know, I think the other biggest part of that is that I think the most, or probably the best quality any police officer can have is being able to do that, just be unbiased. And you know, it seems like it's an easy thing to do, but, you know, sometimes it's not. But if you're able to develop that, you know, that human connection, be unbiased and be non-judgmental, you'd be surprised how these things unfold.
Absolutely. You do have all kinds of important interviews, leads that seem to be very promising that don't amount to anything, but you do have this clear attitude that you find a lot of these stories that I've featured in a lot of books and a lot of documentaries chronicle the disregard for, we'll say, prostitutes or people, drug users, testimony, something that they had witnessed, and so they are dismissed, and then later in hindsight, that was a huge mistake. So you do talk to some people, and you do demonstrate that with that attitude, that part of that attitude of not being judgmental and rather just treating them like any other human being gets you some really significant results. And it does in this case as well, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, it absolutely does. You know, the fact is that, you know, and I always used to joke with a lot of police officers and others that I work with that, you know, but for the grace of God, you'd be the same person. You know, there's this misconception that people somehow, if you're a prostitute or you're a drug user or whatever the case may be, that you're somehow less of a person or you have less of a voice, and that's absolutely incorrect. When you think that or understand and believe that, you know, that everybody is equal regardless of their circumstances, and ironically, some people that seem to be in very challenging or difficult situations are most times, if not all the time, more honest than people who seem to think they have it all or command this sort of attitude that they do. You know, at the end of the day, you know, it's honest in a spiritual way of serving people. I mean, you know, Scripture says that the least among us, you know, and that's the, kind of the attitude that you have to take when you're serving people for whatever reason. But when you do, for whatever reason, believe that somebody has less of a voice than someone else, or someone's, you know, more important than, or going to be more honest than someone else, is kind of where we lose it. And, you know, I definitely appreciate you recognizing that, because I think that's the biggest part of the show that, you know, from my own personal side, that's what I want people to take away from. You know, there are still all sorts of other things that, you know, people may not be able to see that, you know, because they get lost in all the other aspects of the show. But, yeah, I think it's that's probably the biggest for me. And, you know, that's just been the tone of my career.
Absolutely. We talked a little bit about Shreveport, Louisiana, and its film industry, and again, this won't give too much away at all, but this could have led to sort of, again, another lead that led to nothing. But tell us about, you say he worked in the catering industry, but we didn't explain, why is it important that this case gets solved quickly and without much fanfare? Why is that important?
Well, you know, I think when people see something as horrible as this, or any crime that happens, and where that person is affiliated, you know, and the unfortunate thing is that, you know, there are some areas where people don't get that much attention, like we just talked about. But when all eyes are on something, you know, it brings a lot of fear. And what you don't want to do, as any public servant wouldn't want to do, is to seem like you don't have control over you know, people's safety. And if you have an industry like that in, and you know, it's benefiting so many people on so many different levels, you don't want to alarm people. You want to, you know, want to get in there and handle your business and move on. You know, once you fear or the appearance of something that's really not usually the case, kind of pushes people away. So cases where people are hurt or injured, it sometimes depends on who the victim is. You know, it could be someone that works in the industry, like in this particular case, or it could be a young child, or it can be a student, or something that would alarm a certain segment of the population. Now, obviously, all murders, in my opinion, should receive the same attention. But there are some that require extra care, because some people do have preconceived notions, and some people, unfortunately, don't see the things the way, you know, we're talking about it. But you know, that I think that's a big push for, you know, and that's just, I guess that's just about anywhere where, you know, so many people are affected.
We're going to use this as an opportunity, Detective Demery, to talk about the sponsor of our program, which is Breakout Dispatch Games. Murder, romance, scandal, that's my kind of mystery. Dispatch by Breakout Games delivers all that and more straight to your home. Told through clues you receive in the mail, the story draws you in to solve a crime over several months of interactive investigation. I've been playing with my wife for a few months, and trust me, this is pure crime-solving gold. The first series is called On the Run. Once you open your deliver, you'll find yourself entangled in the strange disappearance of your closest childhood friend, who also happens to be suspected of killing his wife, a well-known heiress. With the aid of physical clues and details embedded online, you'll follow each thread to deduce what is farce and what is fiction. Are you intrigued? Satisfy your curious mind with 50% off your first delivery. go to breakoutdispatch.com/true. That's breakoutdispatch, one word, .com/true. Breakout Dispatch Games. Now, Rod, we were talking about the film industry and trying to get this crime solved as quickly as possible, but not just because there's an industry that might feel threatened. It's just because of the way you operate, and it's the thing that you have to do. The longer you leave this, the harder it will be to do this. Now, in this case, again, without giving it away, because there's so much to this story, so many things lead to other things, without giving it away, what is it that solves this case in your mind? What one of those elements in law enforcement that you rely on was that one thing that solved this case?
That would be interview and interrogation. That is, that's the thing that I probably love most about the job, being able to make that connection with someone. And, you know, we can find all sorts of evidence. We can find all sorts of forensics and so on and so forth. But it doesn't really bring it to life. But when someone actually tells you the story, how it happened, and then there's evidence that supports that. You know, it's not good enough for someone to say, you know what, I shot a person, or someone to say this person shot a person. You know, you want to know the details. You want to know exactly how it happened. You want an intimacy that would show that person absolutely had to be there. And for me, in this case, in all cases, actually, is what works for me. There are so many ways to get caught up in, well, it looks like this may be the case, and then, you know, turn out to be completely wrong. So when I work a case, that's what I go for. I go for, you know, a person that can actually relay that story, but not just that, someone that can relay the story and I can support it by evidence that's just there. Heavily relying on you know, forensics or maybe even crime scene type stuff is good stuff, but I don't like to have that doubt. I don't want there to be any doubt, actually. You know, so I think for me in this case, the thing that brought it all together were the interviews and the interrogations.
Right, right. You talk about some of the characters that are in here that you interviewed, and one of the biggest features of this is that because of your experience in Shreveport and this 14 years in the area, you know some of these people. So right away, when there are viable suspects, when people's names come up, it's as easy as putting an alias through the system that you can find this person that this witness described, and then you say, yeah, well, I know that guy. I've dealt with that guy before. How much of an advantage is, in this case, was it to already have some sort of relationship? And again, we talked about how you treat everybody the same, so it really works out for you. How important was it in moving this case forward very quickly at some point?
Oh, yeah, that's a huge advantage. And, you know, police officers are you can tell the ones that are going to be pretty successful because they're immersed in their community. If you have a really good patrol officer, a detective can go to that officer and he'll know his beat. You know, hey, I'm looking for whatever, and you give somebody a nickname, and they can tell you everything about that person, where they last saw them. The same with investigations. You know, you have a relationship with your community, and, you know, some of the suspects and some of the witnesses and definitely the good citizens, because when something like this happens, it's not foreign to you. You can almost say, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, and now it makes sense to me because you know patterns and you know the type of things that they do. You also can figure out who's going to tell you what you need to know. And a knowledge of your community and who you're dealing with is always the biggest advantage. And I've always thought that, actually. I always thought that once you know your terrain and your community, then you're not going to have too many problems navigating it, you know, but if you're detached and you know, you're kind of relying on just, you know, crime scene investigation or hope or dreams, it doesn't work. You know, murder is a very personal crime. And with that, to investigate it, you have to be a very personal person, and you have to be able to get out and talk to people and understand people and all the way things work in your community. I've always thought that the biggest advantage that a police officer had in you know, whether it's firearms training, driving, or whatever else they train us to do is communication. If you're not able to communicate, then you're not going to be very successful. So if you gave me a police officer that was very good at communicating or interacting with people and understanding people, you'd have a very good police officer. Somebody that can do all the mechanics, you know, maybe they can grab fingerprints or whatever. Not necessarily as valuable as somebody that can communicate.
This person that comes up, this alias, and then you had a relationship with him, the thing that really isn't explained here, maybe, again, I'm just curious on this, and again, to explain how you develop relationships other than, you know, treating people as a human being, I mean, that's would be obvious, I would say. But what is it that does, because this is crucial, and again, I won't give this away for the viewers, but when you talk about this person that you find through this alias, this guy obviously has been in the system, and so he's not a lily white character here. So, but how do you manage? What is it that you are able to present to him that he can so easily give up this person? What is it in terms of street cred that you have that I just don't seem to understand, which is unique, I think, about you? What is it that, not so easily, because there's no reward for this guy, that it almost seems like this guy's got some other level of conscience that sometimes you just really don't see?
I think it's all about self-preservation, actually. And the reputation, I guess, or the way that I work cases, you know, after years, people kind of understand that, you know, what's going to happen. You know, if you're not going to close a case, you're not good at closing cases, and people don't expect it. But if people know that you're going to close a case, then most people jump on board. But self-preservation is probably best. Most people will give up anything or anybody if they think they're in jeopardy, and it's easy to kind of pick that out. You know, if you're working the streets and, you know, you run into people like this guy in particular, and, you know, they have, you know, minor charges or they're always in and out of trouble, they know that you're relentless. So if you go ask them a question or you want to know something, they don't want your attention focused on them. It's probably the best way to describe it. I don't know that it has anything to do with the actual police officer, you know, and you know, our skills, I think, is probably more of our reputation or the reputation you develop, and that person's desire to keep themselves, you know, below the radar or self-preservation. You know, that there's that old adage, you know, there's no honor among thieves, and that's absolutely true. You know, it's all, sometimes it can be every man for themselves.
Were you surprised? I mean, obviously, throughout this investigation, you have your assumptions and theories on terms of motive, the why. The why must really gnaw at you at times when it can't be solved. So along the way, I'm sure that's what you're thinking of, assuming, thinking ahead, theorizing. Overall, was this a surprise to you, or is this... How much of a surprise was this in the end in terms of why?
Well, yeah, it was. And you know, I think the gnawing question when you work cases, initially that's the first thing that comes to mind is why. But I think the reason for the question initially is different, because you want to know why, because you want to make sense of it so you can solve the case. But that question why develops as the case continues. You know, when you start to get more leads and more evidence, then you want to know, well, why would they go to that extreme? And then when you finally get to the end of the case, the why changes to, well, why did this happen? You know, it's I think that question starts, but I think it kind of matures over the course of the investigation. At least it did for me. You know, it's kind of primal at first. You know, well, why did this happen? So you can piece it together. And then, you know, the next step, and then the next step. And then finally at the end, you come to this big question. And, you know, I think what's probably more important is that, you know, as I came to the end of my career, I looked at all the cases and asked, why does it happen at all? So it, I don't know if it's a question that ever goes away. I think it just gets more intense, you know.
Now, you talk about, in this particular case, and I mean, I think this is the kind of cliche you don't just throw around, but you talk about evil and the devil, and you've had interaction with this guy before. So what was it most about this person in terms of, yeah, what was most about this person that separated him from all these other people and many of the people, even in homicides, that you interacted with over the years?
Well, I think that there are different types of suspects, and some people have the ability to actually have some level of compassion for another person, and there are people that are just relentlessly evil. I mean, and they inflict injury and harm upon people just because there's something there. I can't even begin to assume, you know, whatever psychological state they may be into, or anything that would actually motivate something that can be so gruesome. But what I can say is that I believe that, and this is just based on my own personal observations, is that you know, spiritually, some people are just unbalanced, and I don't know necessarily if it's that person or just you know, how they lost their way, but I guess maybe you can draw that conclusion if, you know, I guess each individual can. You know, someone looking at it as a psychologist may draw one conclusion, or somebody as a sociologist may draw another, you know, whether it was a home life or something. But, you know, I'm just a basic spiritual kind of guy, and I know that there have been examples in the scripture where people seem to be, they've lost their way for whatever reason. And that's just personally my opinion. It's not something to say that, you know, someone may in another area disagree with it. But I think my opinion is that people have that ability, and I base that solely upon what I believe spiritually.
It's very interesting too. You include that in this television series as well, and in this. That when you did get the call about this particular case, you were actually at that place that you're talking about, the church, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. That, you know, and that's, it's just who I am. And I don't believe that, you know, all the things that have happened, you know, my mother being murdered, my brother going to prison, all these other things that I see around me daily, you know, it's never a question of, you know, why did all this happen? It's why did I survive it? And, well, that's because that's God's grace, and for whatever reason, you know, that's what I was chose to do. Hence the name of the program, and I think that it's all for the greater good. I think that my comfort was to give someone else comfort, and their comfort is to give someone else comfort. And I think when all people that actually concern themselves or care about people, all the good people get together, then, you know, evil starts to dissipate. But when every man kind of believes what's right in his own heart, then, you know, we all know the conclusion of that. But yeah, it's very important, and I do that probably in every show, interview, or aspect of my life, because I do recognize the grace and the mercy, and for whatever reason, I don't find myself ever in a position to judge anyone for what they do. I judge the acts, you know, and if this guy's committed a very evil act, you know, I don't know that puts me in a position to judge him as a person, because it doesn't, but it certainly speaks to, you know, the evil forces or behavior that is completely among us.
You talk about your brother, if you don't mind, and if you talk about your brother being convicted of murder. And then I hear your attitude towards not judging the person, but judging the crime. How important is your attitude towards your brother and that relationship that you do have to the work that you do and have done in as a homicide detective, and now with this work, telling the stories of your career to a bigger audience?
Yeah, I think actually, I think that my brother's conviction for murder is probably what made me recognize that even more. I think it amplified it in the fact that, you know, that is nothing but, in my opinion, that's nothing but God's grace saying, you know, this could be anybody, you know, and it doesn't put you in a position where, you know, most people can look at someone and say, oh, God, you know, that person's a monster. They're this, that, and the other. But, you know, it kind of changes your perception on that. And for me, it does. You know, I see the evil acts. But at the same time, I can see the, at some point, they were somebody else's brother or sister or whomever they were. So I think the fact that I was able to experience that firsthand, I don't easily dismiss a person. You know, I can absolutely be totally against whatever act that they've committed or whatever crime they've committed. But I don't know that I can do that with that person, probably because I don't think anyone's in a position to judge anybody like that, and you really don't know. As a homicide detective, I think, or a police officer, or anybody that's in a position like that, I think we kind of lose it when people think they can do that. You know, you can't really judge people for whatever. I think you judge the act and whatever happens. In my brother's case, you know, what my brother's crimes were, he's going to be punished for them. You know, to be able to, for me, to be able to look at him as my brother, I can absolutely do that. But at the same time, I have to also take into consideration that he committed a very evil act. So, you know, it's a balancing act. And, you know, I truly believe that that's just a teaching, you know, that's a spiritual maturity that you arrive at. You know, you have all these things that happen in your life, and when you get to a certain point, it all comes to a head and gives you more direction and meaning. So where you look at a crime victim and you look at a person who's committed a crime, or you look at people who are watching all this happen, and you come to the same conclusion, you know, all these people are people. And when you decide that you can, you know, kind of judge who's, you know, the type of person that should be a crime victim or who the type of person should be a crime is when you're getting out of line, and you'll see a bunch of chaos at that point.
Before you got to this point in maturity and acceptance, you were 3 years old when your mother was murdered. How did you reconcile that? We didn't talk about how that happened or who that was that murdered her. How did you... Without doing that, how did you reconcile this and be able to, and not that there is such a thing as closure or getting over, but how did you move forward? How did you reconcile the murder of your mother?
Well, I think as I learned more about the story, I realized that all the things that had happened to my mother were actually for the greater good. You know, in my belief, I think that the scripture's right on point when God talks about before he formed you in your mother's womb, he knew who you were, you know, what you were going to do. And I think as I grew, it was a perfect balance, you know. My mother was murdered about the time I didn't have a whole lot of memory of it, but I saw the effect of everyone else around her, including my grandparents, you know, as my grandmother mourned and my grandfather's concerns. And I saw how it affected my brother with the anger he had towards the man who killed our mother. And, you know, I got to a point where I saw the man who actually killed our mother and had a conversation with him and
wow.
Interviewed him and interrogated him. And I realized that, you know, I think I was, it's not something that happened overnight. You know, I was probably, you know,
sure.
In my 30s, I realized that, you know, the forgiveness and whatever I had to do was all in me. And if I didn't, I would probably internalize things like my brother or go through the grief that my grandmother went through. And all that translates into a healing or a reconciliation that I was able to give to someone else. So when I go out and work a crime, I could bring that to the surviving victims. And, you know, sometimes even the people who committed the crimes, and they in turn can give to someone else. And it kind of has a chain reaction. None of that happened overnight, you know, because it was pretty confusing growing up and wondering why. But as I got deeper into it, I realized that, you know, some of these things happen. And like I said, it's not a matter of why did they happen. It's why did I survive? And, you know, what's my purpose? Fortunately for me, I was blessed enough to figure out my purpose and be able to kind of walk in that purpose. And in the end, you the reward you get is a peace, you know, and I think that's what everybody seeks. As long as people are of the mindset where they actually want to help other people instead of themselves, I think you'll see a lot more balance.
Yeah. Getting back to this first episode, it's very interesting that you have the separate elements where you are going to this very crucial interview with a person that you think is among the worst you've ever seen. You're getting to that point. And at the same time, we have, again, we talked about Troy, the guy that worked in the film industry, and he, we'll give this a little bit away, at least he recovers, so he doesn't die. He recovers. So you have the back and forth between this interview and what you're going to gain from it. You have DNA evidence. You have fingerprint evidence. You have now the main witness to know more of the why. So know more of the why. So very interesting developments back and forth in this ongoing mystery. Leads from, again, prostitutes, from people that you already know and have encountered and have significant police records. This is an incredible unfolding, and all the people, again, the separate elements, these people come together with you and your partner, Detective Mitchell, to be able to solve this case. In the other episodes, you have 10 episodes this season. I assume there were 10 episodes last season.
Yes.
Just tell us a little bit about some of the upcoming cases that you will be covering, just sort of the general brief description of some of those cases that you'll be covering in this season of Murder Chose Me.
Yeah, you're right. There are 10 episodes. There were 10 episodes last season. And, you know, the cases are vastly different in different areas that kind of stuck out to me. You know, cases of domestic violence, cases of crimes that were committed against people for their sexual orientation or preference, or cases that are assumed to be drug cases, or you know, the presumption of all sorts of different things. And I think most of the cases that I work, I look for that thread that separates each case. And I think the upcoming season will kind of illustrate that pretty well, that, you know, police and solving homicides can actually individualize people. And I think when, you know, everything's painted with a broad brush, then you don't get that individual aspect of it. And I think that it's absolutely necessary, especially in crimes like this, murder. It's a very personal crime, you know, and it affects so many different people, but it affects so many different people on different levels. And it absolutely affects the people that are closest to the people that are killed. And my prayer, my hope was to bring, you know, that story, you know, that particular story, that person's story to life, rather than, you know, we have this type of crime or that type of crime. And I think if you, yeah, like I said, I'm glad they've done such a great job with it, because, I mean, right off the top, you recognize the things that I was, you know, desiring people to recognize immediately. So I think that's the goal of it.
You talk about that you're very happy with that, and that the very, very sensitive and, sensitive treatment of everybody involved in this. And you can see that that's not sensationalized in any way. It's very respectful. Maybe you can tell us just about the people that you worked with on this to bring this, because it is a very, very good series. So maybe you could just tell us a little bit about that and working on this and your actual participation. How we can see just from the series itself your involvement, but tell us about your hands-on participation in this production.
Yeah, the production company, Jupiter Entertainment, they were very, very, very good in allowing me to express me and what my thoughts were about cases. And I think that's the reason why you don't see a lot of sensationalism. And it's very heavily weighted towards the victims and the respect for them. and likewise, investigation discovery is phenomenal in doing that and telling stories and allowing that to go forward. And I think, you know, I probably couldn't ask for a better production company or people in that production company and network to produce it. The actor who plays me, it was just, you know, phenomenal. I mean, that he and I were able to connect. And when we met, it, you know, there are so many similarities and so many personality traits that we shared. In fact, you know, it wasn't just work. We became friends. So, you know, the transition for him or him, you know, just hanging out, you know, he kind of knows the way I think or the way I would react to something. And it just gets better, you know, from the first year we met until now. I mean, he can almost predict what I'm going to say or what I'm going to think. So I think it was a perfect storm that made everything work out just right. And, of course, obviously the families that were involved. You know, I maintain relationships with most of the crime victims and families, and, you know, almost to a point where, you know, gosh, you know, we're friends. So knowing their wishes and being able to convey them, I think it just worked out great.
You talk about the first season, and you've alluded to that you've kept in touch with the families. And obviously, we know from the general audience, it's a hit. So there is that acceptance. And you say that the translation, and lots of people complain about taking their project, their product, and then not being completely satisfied with the end result. But you, instead of talk about it in the opposite, basically, that you're ecstatic about this, and I don't blame you. What has been the reaction from those people involved? And I think that's what you would, you know, you'd want to know what their specific reaction is to an episode. Did you get anyone's response? Tell us about that experience, if any.
Yeah, I usually get response because I try to talk with most people before and during production of it. So, you know, I can kind of see their wishes. I think the most important thing is that, you know, these aren't really actually my stories, they're their stories. So if you decide you want to, you know, fit it to what you want to be, I want it to be, I think that's where you come to a problem. And, you know, with this particular project, you know, everybody is kind of respectful for the other person's wishes and thoughts. And, you know, and at the end of the day, the big concern is the community and the family. And, you know, for that, I'm very grateful. You know, that's the thing to be ecstatic about, the fact that you can tell those stories and kind of immortalize. You know, if there's someone that was, you know, otherwise forgotten for such a crime, you know, there's an entire world that knows them now. And probably the most incredible thing is somebody from across the world, you know, praying and mourning with someone from Shreveport, and that's probably the best feeling ever. So. Yeah, you're right. I'm ecstatic about that, and I think it's probably because it's more about the situation and people kind of humanizing each other again and understanding each other's pain and grief and yeah, just what in my pain, I think that's what makes it work.
It's interesting too, isn't it? Having been a homicide detective and looking at this, the incredible interest in true crime. And some people might think that that's a negative thing, but of course we know that it's a very, very positive thing, this renewed interest in true crime, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I think that's probably something that was going to happen. I mean, if, you know, society goes into a decline and people are getting hurt and people are almost becoming desensitized to certain crimes, I think it's really important that we re-engage. And the fascination with true crime, you know, even if it's voluntary or involuntary, I think people are drawn to it because they can, you know, share in the stories, the fears and the pains. And I think that's probably the best part of it. You know, I don't know that there's a satisfaction in people seeing other people grieve. I think it's probably just the opposite. It's how to stop.
Yeah.
And at least that's what I'm seeing in. And I get a lot of that from the response. I mean, people that message or send messages in from all over the world, it's the same exact thing. And that's amazing to me.
Yeah. It is an amazing series. It's very well done. Incredibly respectful and sensitive and very exciting. And I got to say, an incredible production, very well done. I want to thank you very much, Detective Rod Demery, for coming on. We have to mention, maybe you can tell the audience when it premieres. Tell us that for our audience as you part.
Yes, yeah, second season premieres April 4th at 9 p.m. Central, 10 Eastern on Investigation Discovery, the ID channel.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Detective Rod Demery, for coming on and talking about Murder Chose Me. I look forward to the episodes and all the episodes this season and going back into season one and see what I missed. So thank you very much, and you have a great evening.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Good night.